Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is Brad Helene, the current bass player in Boston's legendary Nervous Eaters. The group has been around since 1977 and had various lineups since. Their debut single and signature song, Loretta, has been remixed for their current single, out now on Wicked Cool Records, and it's the flip side, the A-side, Wild Eyes, that is the recent coolest song in the world. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Brad on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Don't say much, 'cause there's not too much to say. I never call, but I just can't stay away. She has a reach that grabs you, so very weird to say.
Manfred here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it is time for your coolest conversations. Joining me today is Brad Helene, bass player in the current version of the legendary Boston band Nervous Eaters. Their latest single is this week's coolest song in the world, Wild Eyes. Brad's music career is quite varied and includes playing with the likes of Ministry, Amy Mann, and Roomful of Blues. How are you, Brad?
Doing pretty well, Manfred. How are you?
I'm hanging in there pretty well. I'm very happy to be chatting with you today. And before we start talking specifically about the new Nervous Eaters single, I wanted to find out some more about your background because, as I mentioned, you've played with all sorts of artists, and I read online that you graduated from Andrew Ward High School in Fairfield, Connecticut. So are you from Fairfield originally?
No, actually I'm not. My father worked for General Telephone back in the day, and he's still alive, actually. He's 92. But he got transferred a lot. So my family's all from Illinois, except for me. Everybody was born in Illinois. I was born in outside Seattle, Washington, when my father was in the Navy. I'm the oldest of three, and we moved a lot. So we moved to Connecticut in my sophomore year of high school.
And when did you start playing the bass?
Fourth grade.
What drew you to the instrument? I mean, you began with bass?
Yes. What drew me to the instrument was February 9th, 1964. We all know what that means. The Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I mean, I was 7 years old, and my brother and I were jumping up and down like maniacs. He was four, I was seven, and that ignited everything. But I started actually playing classical music, and I played acoustic bass, and I still do, in an orchestra to start with, and then, you know, played electric bass as well as time went on.
So when did you start those acoustic bass lessons?
Fourth grade.
So it was fourth grade. Well, when you mentioned moving around a lot growing up, I was wondering if, you know, if music was some, like,
if music was maybe a refuge from the, some sort of certainty, you know, you could explore music and stuff, or such as, you know, that wasn't the case.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was a refuge and it still is. I think, you know, all of us who love music find that there's a lot of solace in music. And, you know, my brother and I were always very avid collectors, and we grew up in a great time in music, being in the early 70s and late 60s.
So, I'm sorry, say that again?
I said we grew up in a great time in music in my family, my brother and I, in the late 60s and early 70s when we started buying lots of LPs and 45s.
And so your brother, you mentioned he's 3 years younger than yourself. Was he also playing an instrument when you guys were kids?
He's unfortunately no longer with us. But yes, he was a great musician and filmmaker and just all-around artist, great photographer.
So your parents were pretty supportive of you guys' music endeavors?
My mother in particular. My first music lesson came from her. We were Presbyterians, and the first record that I ever recorded, I was 7 years old, and we were living, maybe 8 years old, we were living in Bloomington, Illinois at that time, and there was the church we went to, Presbyterian Church, there were eight different choirs there, eight different age groups, and our choir director was pretty legendary, this guy named Irv Martin, and all the choirs were excellent, and we recorded a record for Decca Records. I still have it, actually. But my mother, when we were going to church as very, very young kids, she taught me, she was like, okay, I'm going to sing this note and you sing this note. And she would, you know, sing a third above the root. And that's how I learned harmony and, you know, started to get my ear together a little bit. She was a very good singer and a good piano player herself.
So while you were in high school, did you form any groups with any other fellow students?
Of course. Yeah. We had a group in high school that we did mostly covers. So I graduated high school in 75. So, and we were doing, you know, and even before that, when I was in eighth grade, I was playing electric bass in seventh and eighth grade. You know, we were doing like rock and soul, rock and soul music by Country Joe and the Fish, because we had the Woodstock album and a lot of Grand Funk tunes and, you know, whatever we were listening to at the time. And then the band that I had in high school, which was a pretty popular local band, we did, you know, Marshall Tucker, Allman Brothers tunes, a lot of Dave Mason, Traffic, stuff like that.
So when you graduate and you get out of high school, did you go on to college, or were you like, was your college kind of your after high school education, was that just already playing in bands?
2 weeks after I graduated high school, I was on the road. And I'll tell you a quick story. So before I graduated, this was in Fairfield, Connecticut, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, there was, you know, back in those days, 74, 75, every hotel had a lounge and every lounge had a band and every band played 5-6 sets a night, 6 nights a week. It was, you know, at that time, everything that was on the radio was Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, Average White Band, Rufus. And so I found this booking agency in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Complex 4. The guy's name was Dick Grass. Got the address, went down there. I walked in. He was sitting at his desk. He looked up at me and said, you know, what can I do for you, kid? I said, well, I'm looking for a gig. And he goes, you're looking for a gig? I said, yeah. He said, well, are you any good? What do you play? I said, yeah, I'm pretty good. I play bass. He goes, well, give me your phone number. So I gave him my phone number. I went home. About 2 hours later, I get a phone call from this guy, DJ, who was a drummer in one of his bands that was on the road. He lived in Wethersfield, Connecticut. And he said, hey, I got your number from Dick Grass. How do you like that for a name, Dick Grass? It's like a stereotypical booking agent's name.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So this guy DJ calls me up and he goes, hey, I got your number from Dick Grass. He goes, he said, you're looking for a gig. You any good? You play bass? I'm looking for a bass player. And I said, yeah, I'm pretty good. So he goes, well, play me something. I said, what do you mean, right now over the phone? He goes, yeah. So I played him the lick to keep playing that rock and roll by Edgar Winter off the White Trash record, the second album. Just that lick that goes boo boo da ba da ba da boo doo da. I just played him that lick and he goes, okay, great, you got the gig, you're hired. Meet me at the Treadway Motor at the Hi Ho Motel on the Merritt Parkway, which is right down the street from my parents' house where we lived. And he picked me up there, and I a couple of weeks after I graduated, and we started that night. I didn't know any of the songs they were doing. We had like a 4-hour rehearsal in the afternoon, and I started that night. And I played in three different bands with that agency, and then and learned a ton, because all the people that I was working with were at least 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
And for a bass player, like I said, it was all Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, Average White Band, Rufus, and then all the disco stuff. And the bass lines were heavy. It was a lot of, it was a real learning curve, and I got thrown right into it. And it was a good learning experience. Really good.
Well, I'm trying to remember here from reading the bio, you mentioned whipping out the Edgar Winter lick on the guy, but did you actually play with Johnny Winter at some point or record with Johnny Winter?
That's an amazing thing for me, because, my brother and I were both, I saw Johnny Winter and many times when Derringer was in the band with, it was the McCoys, the guys right. That hang on Sloopy. So it was Randy Hobbs and his brother, and Rick Derringer's real name was Zeringer, actually.
Right.
So it was Rick and Randy,
right? His brother, Randy Zeringer, yeah.
Well, the bass player was Randy Joe Hobbs. So,
okay.
And then Bobby Caldwell was the drummer in Johnny Winter Ann. But so I saw that group many times, many times, around the time the live record was out, Johnny Winter Ann, and the studio record before that. So, we were huge fans. And so, that's much later in my career. Fast forward, I got to play on, he did a record on Virgin called I'm a Blues Man, and I'm on that record.
Did you also record with Iggy Pop at some point?
I did.
When was that?
Going much fast forward. So after I got out of those top 40 bands, I was like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I need to I need to do something here. It was either New York or Boston. At the time, my parents were living in Kentucky. They'd got transferred to there. So yeah. I went down there the summer of 77 and actually saw the Some Girls tour. That was cool, at Rupp Arena in Lexington. But I decided to move to Boston because the singer that was in my high school band was living in Boston. So I was like, okay, I know one person in Boston, nobody in New York. Boston gets the short straw. So... So I moved to Boston, and I was in a band within days of coming to Boston. Boston had such a vibrant scene in 77. I mean, the Rat was happening and all of the great local bands, including the Eaters at that time. And so there's a lot that happened there. And Willie Alexander and the Boom Boom Band, which were on MCA at the time, which David McLean is the drummer in the Nervous Eaters now with me. And he was in the Boom Boom Band at that time in 77, Willie Alexander and the Boom Boom Band. So, yeah. So I don't know where you want to pick it up from here.
Well, what I wanted to, I had a question here about, saying in 1980, the Nervous Eaters issued their eponymous debut album. And what band were you in at the time? Because you were in Boston at that time. But first, I wanted to find out specifically about that the Iggy Pop thing. What record is that that you're on, or did it ever come out? The recording?
Well, it didn't come out for a long, long time. And how that came about was, so around 1980, I left the band that I was in, which was called Pastiche, which was a very popular pop band that was in the punk scene, and playing all the venues, and we had a couple singles out, and I was playing with this other group of musicians called Adventure Set, and I noticed these two guys that were hitting on my girlfriend, and they were good looking guys, and I was getting kind of pissed off. So I went up to him on the break, and it happened to be Vince Ely from the Psychedelic Furs, the drummer from the Psychedelic Furs, and Ian Taylor, who was Roy Thomas Baker's main man. And they were in town producing a group from Chicago called Ministry. And they said, oh, we're talking to your girlfriend over here, but but we also were admiring your bass playing. Would you be interested in coming down and doing a session at Synchro Sound, which was the Cars studio? Mm-hmm. And I said, sure. So I went down, and make a long story short, I ended up joining the band. And the band was recording in Boston. And as a result of that, I got to be pretty close with Rick and Elliot. I played on Elliot Easton's solo record that was on Elektra as well. And Rick was hiring me for sessions. And one of them was Iggy Pop. And wow. It was basically the guys in Ministry were on the session. It was Al, Stephen George Fondas, otherwise known as Steve-O, and myself. And we cut like, I don't know, 4 to 6 songs. And it didn't come out for a long, long time. I saw a bootleg of it at Bleecker Bob's like 20 years ago or something. Or just, I was hanging on the wall. I was like, wait a minute, you know. But it never came out. And then some Swedish label or something picked it up. And it's on a compilation of unreleased Iggy Pop tunes. And I can't remember the name of the record, but it is available on Amazon now.
Very, very cool. So did you work with him in the studio at all?
With who?
Well, Iggy Pop. I mean, were you...
Yeah.
It's like a session where, you're just coming and playing the tracks, or was he there at the same time? Did you get to interact with him at all?
It was a great hang. He talked about playing golf the whole time.
Do you play golf?
Do I?
Yeah.
My family are big golfers. And I, you know, my father tried to get me interested in playing golf, but I was too interested in music and I never really, you know, had the patience for it. But my dad was a pretty good golfer. And
well, did you ever get back together with your dad and say, Dad, if only I had taken you up on the golfing, I was hanging out with Iggy Pop and all he wanted to do was talk about golfing.
Yeah. He talked about a lot of stuff too, but he did talk about playing golf a lot. He was a great hang, very intelligent guy and funny and, you know, inspiring to be around for sure.
All right. So 1980 is when that Nervous Eaters, they issued their debut album. And you were in Pastiche, or you had just left Pastiche around that time?
1980, I was still in Pastiche.
Yep. You're still in play. So you played shows with the Nervous Eaters around that time?
As a matter of fact, we did. And I'll tell you one show that we played, and Steve and I talk about this a lot. I mean, we played a show together at a really nice venue called the Bradford Ballroom, which was a big venue in downtown Boston. And the date was December 8th, 1980.
December. And what happened?
That was the night John Lennon was assassinated.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, okay. I see. Yeah.
And we had played our set. And in the dressing room, the Pats game was on. And Cosell came on the game and he said, Ronald Reagan's been shot. And then he backtracked. He said, wait a minute. It was John Lennon.
Yeah.
And we did play shows. That was one of them that we did. But I didn't know Steve that well back then, but I always admired. To me, Steve Cataldo is criminally unknown to the world at large as a songwriter. He's just a great songwriter. He always, always has been. He's a triple threat as a singer, guitar player, songwriter.
Well, would you have ever guessed that you would be in the band some 40 years later working with them at that time?
I don't know if I would have guessed it or not. I was probably too full of myself to even think about it.
Well, how did you wind up working with Steve then? How did you come to be in the Nervous Eaters now?
Okay, well, I did a tenure with the Eaters in 1987. I was with Steve the first time, and the bass chair opened up. It was a pretty revolving door of musicians. I mean, he's the alumni in the Eaters is almost like Room Full of Blues, which was another group that I spent 5 years playing in. And so the bass chair became open, and you know, Steve is a very deep guy. I mean, besides, you know, the British invasion stuff and all the normal rock and roll stuff, he knows a lot about American music, especially like the Chess catalog and other blues genres from that period of time, different, you know, because blues is, you know, it's different depending on the location. But he knows a lot about the Chess catalog. He's a huge James Brown fan and knows a lot about Southern Soul, Stax, High Records, American Studios, all that stuff. And So the bass chair became open in the Eaters, and I got in touch with him. I knew the guitar player that was playing in the band at the time, and he recommended me, and he said, so Steve called me. He said, well, if you want to play in the Eaters, you got to play in my blues band first, and I got to see how you do. So he gave me a cassette tape of a bunch of blues standards like Killing Floor and a couple Sonny Boy tunes like Your Funeral, My Trial, No More Frogs for Snakes, Mother Earth by Memphis Slim. I still have the cassette tape.
Yeah.
And so I did. And I did that. And I hadn't really played blues before, like in a real traditional. And the harp player that was in that group was Tony Cagnitas. He was played with Luther Snake Johnson. So anyway, so I did pretty well, and he gave me the gig. And I worked with Steve for probably close to 2 years. And then the guitar player and I left, and we started a band called The Joneses, and that group was signed by Ahmet Erdogan to Atlantic Records.
And then how did you reconnect with Steve and start playing with the Eaters again?
So that's, so now we're looking at like 1990 is the time frame I just left off at with you there. So we stayed in touch on and off, you know, through the years. And Steve is the type of guy, I mean, he's the real deal. He has to write. He's a true artist in every sense of the word. You know, he's not one of these, you know, part-timer type guys. We stayed in touch, and, you know, just from, you know, not all the time, but at least like once a year or every 2 years, you know, we'd talk, and I'd ask him how things were going. And so then, you know, fast forward up to 2019, you know, the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, at that time I was playing in Duke Robillard's band, who's I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a blues guitar player.
Right, right. And he was also part of Roomful of Blues too.
Yeah, we started Roomful.
Yeah.
He also played and toured with Bob Dylan, Tom Waits. You know, he's incredible. I spent 12 years in his group touring the world, made a lot of records with him. It was time for me, my brother had passed away, and it was just time for me to make a change. And this was right before the pandemic happened. Mm-hmm. And I had given Duke my notice. And within like 2 days of that, Steve called me up and he said, hey, my bass player left. Do you know any bass players? You got any students, or do you know anybody that would be interested in doing the gig? I said, well, as a matter of fact, you know, I'm free right now. And so the next thing you know, I was getting together with him. And you know, then we did one gig March 7th of 2020, and then everything shut down.
Right.
And we didn't get together for a while. We rehearsed for a while, and then we didn't get together for a while because everybody was afraid of getting sick. But then we slowly started getting going again. And, you know, I suggested to him that I was just loving the new material. And I said, we should record some of this stuff. We should do a demo. And so we went into a friend of mine's studio and we cut three songs, and, you know, the rest is history as far as our relationship is cultivating with you guys, you know, what's happened here.
Let's talk a moment about Adam Sherman, the other guitar player. You mentioned Dave McLean and other stuff he had done on the Boston scene. What about Adam? Is he also a longtime player on the Boston scene?
Absolutely. He was in a band that was on A&M. Called Private Lightning, and they were really making a lot of noise in town, you know, in the 80s. And then he was in a band called The Souls, which was also a very popular group in Boston, and people loved him. And yeah, Adam is also a triple threat, really good guitar player, excellent singer, and a really good songwriter. We're actually doing one of his tunes now in the live set.
Oh, very cool. Well, the notes I was handed about the new single in our coolest song of the world this week, Wild Eyes, says that the recording was produced by you and Steve Cataldo. When did you record that?
So that was done, it's everything's just kind of a blur. So that was done, and I think we started doing basic tracks for that, for the record in general. We did the demo in November of 2020.
Okay.
And within a very short period of time, our good friend Steve Berkowitz, who's the executive producer on the record, you know, had gotten it to Stephen Van Zandt, and Mr. Van Zandt really liked the record. I mean, really liked the demo, and so we had a deal basically. So we started cutting the basics in March of 2021, and we were up against a lot because people, you know, the pandemic was still going, and people that we were working with, you know, had been getting sick and et cetera, et cetera. But we started recording in March of 2021. And we did the basics at Q Division in Boston, which is a great studio, Somerville, actually, Somerville, Mass. And then we moved down to where we did the demo to a good friend of ours' studio, Jack Gauthier, who owns a studio called Lake West in Coventry, Rhode Island. And he's a seriously talented guy, great guitar player himself and singer. And he ended up doing all the background vocals with me on the record.
So you mentioned, you know, this is all going on still where the pandemic is lingering about. So when you guys are playing, were you playing all recording all together live in the studio, or were people coming in one at a time, or how did you organize the sessions?
We went in as a group. The basics, you know, were all cut live in one room, just like old school. And then, you know, with minimal fixes, and then, you know, we layered stuff on top per usual.
So the particular track, Wild Eyes, do you know if any one pair of eyes inspired Steve?
Well, you know, probably, you know, when you get to be our age, you know, many pairs of eyes, you know, it's a song about relationships. I mean, aren't all great songs about relationships?
Oh, many are, yes.
You know, and love, and, you know, all the parameters that go around, you know, all of that.
So Steve writes all the band's material. I mean, you mentioned the other guitar player, adding Adam having a track that's in the live set, but Steve predominantly is the songwriter for the Nervous Eaters. What was it like working with Steve and co-producing the track?
It was good, really good. We're very like-minded. Mm-hmm. We both love all the British Invasion stuff, you know, obviously the Beatles and the Stones, but, you know, the Dave Clark Five and all the groups that were the Animals, you know, that were around during that time. And then we also have a huge love for American roots music, you know, blues and R&B and soul. And we love Tom Petty and all of the things that make a good song. So it was a good, you know, we're both very opinionated and pretty headstrong, but we, you know, we worked well together.
So Wild Eyes, the single's out on Wicked Cool Records, and you were talking about Steve Van Zandt, that's his label, and you did enough material for an album. When is that due out? Do you have any idea yet?
The album is dropping in November.
All right, very cool.
And apparently there's quite a schedule. I believe, well, the first single, Wild Eyes, which is backed with the original version of Loretta that was on the Rat label. Jimmy Harold was the owner of the club, and he also owned the record company. Loretta was recut when the band was on Elektra, but this is the original version remastered. And so that's coming out actually on a physical 45 at some point in time. We haven't gotten them yet, but they're coming soon. The single, yes, drops June 24th. And then there's going to be a schedule of four more songs, from what I understand, leading up to the release of the record.
Right. So this Wild Eyes will be available as a physical single backed with the remix version of Loretta. And then just prior to the album coming out, typically what they'll do is release digital tracks off of it as a way to promote the actual album's release.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly done a lot of touring over the course of your career. How active are the Nervous Eaters in terms of doing live gigs? And I know this is just kind of, we're getting out of the pandemic now, but how active are those guys generally in terms of doing live gigs, and how active do you want to be these days?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, just being a full-time musician since 1975, I can tell you right now that, you know, I'm used to personally doing about 300 dates a year, and yeah, quite a few records on top of it as well. And I'm at about 35 or 40% of that right now, mm-hmm, which is better than nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do a lot of different stuff. The Eaters, it's not like it was back in the day, you know, with original music. There's so many tribute bands and everything now that are kind of taking up a lot of space. But we're playing a couple gigs a month right now.
Okay.
You know, just to keep everything loose and tight at the same time. But yeah, we want to go on the road. Of course we do. We want to get out there and do it. We want to work, but it all depends on how well the record's received and, you know, all of that. So if we have something to promote and people are liking it, we'll be happy to come to your town and play the songs.
Well, when do you have a gig lined up? When's the next one?
The next gig is July 15th at the Brighton Music Hall, which is a really nice venue in Brighton, Massachusetts, which is basically Boston. And we it's a really great bill. We also have, I don't know if you've ever heard of Robin Lane. She was a popular artist back in the day here. Robin Lane and the Chartbusters, they were on Warner Brothers. She's on the bill. And there's another act on the bill too, Linnea's Garden. And they have a good following. So that's July 15th. That's our next date.
We mentioned the B-side to the single, this remastered version of Loretta. And I guess what my notes had said, it was newly mixed, but I guess, is it remastered and remixed?
It's just remastered.
It's just remastered. Yeah. Generally regarded as the band's signature song. Why did you guys think to go back to Loretta to remaster it?
Well, we feel, and Steve Berkowitz was very instrumental in this decision here, that the band has an incredible story. You know, first of all, the four of us are all, you know, the band, you know, with the four of us in it is quite a legacy of Boston music history. And, you know, Steve Berkowitz calls this single the smallest box set in the world. And, you know, it's kind of a bookending then and now. And, you know, it goes along, parallels the story. And if you read the bio that we put together and all the things we've put together for the leading up to the release here, you'll see that the reason why we did it.
Well, Brad, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, I really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for having me. And it's great to be here representing the Nervous Eaters. And we're super excited about the release of our record, which is, the name of the album is called Monsters and Angels. It'll be coming out in November on Wicked Cool Records. And we're psyched.
All right. Well, let's get the listen to that B-side now. It's Loretta in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Let me go.
West Boston's Nervous Eaters with some of their signature tune, Loretta, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Originally released in 1977, the song has been remixed and is the B-side to their new single out now on Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's bass player, Brad Helene, for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, I'll be joined by Marcel McCree, the lead singer and frontman in the Athens, Greece band called The Fabulous Heydays. Their debut album is, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Heydays. We'll find out all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.